Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Back. We've had a couple of weeks off enjoying the summertime, but here we are again on Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. Thank you to all the listeners. We are blown away by the interest you have in this show, approaching 150,000 of you downloading the show and enjoying it and using it, hopefully using it for training, and as well as just keeping up with what's going on and getting some insight from some good folks in this business. And speaking of good people and all the guests we've had on this show this week, our guest is FDNY's Battalion Chief Freddie LaFamina of FDNY Special Operations, who is also the FEMA USAR Task Force Leader of New York Task Force 1. Fred's going to talk to us a little bit about the recent tragic fire in the Bronx that took the lives of FDNY Lieutenant Howie Karpluck, as well as probationary firefighter Mike Riley. And then we're going to talk about USAR teams, local teams, and the whole USAR concept. And I think you'll enjoy what he has to say. And he'll bring you up to speed on some things that are going on with USAR. And some reflections on some good, bad, and not so, some mediocre stuff that's been going on with USAR as well. But it should be a really good interview with Freddie in a little while. Between now and then, I've got a couple updates for you. Number one, a tragic loss again on the loss of a California Department of Forestry plane crashed and claimed the lives of two firefighters. Fire and airlines investigators are examining a craft that crashed this past week in the Mountain Home Demonstration State Forest and claimed the lives of two California Department of Forestry firefighters. Battalion Chief Robert Paul Stone of CDF Fire Protection and Pilot George Sandy Willett were both killed in the crash shortly after 10:30 a.m. This past Wednesday while on a mission east of Springville in Tulare County, California. Battalion Chief Stone, 36 years old, was a resident of Azalea, 18-year member of the CDF. He survived by his wife, Mary Stone, and two kids, Will, age 8, and Libby, age 4. And the pilot, Willett, was a resident of Hanford and a pilot for 4 years. He is survived by his wife, Judy. They're going to be following up on the investigation to see what killed those two firefighters. Our hearts and prayers go out to the CDF members in your recent loss. Two members of our service lost their lives overseas. Bryn Athen, Pennsylvania firefighter and soldier Tristan C. Smith, and three other soldiers based in Fort Hood, Texas, were killed in an explosion in Baghdad just a couple weeks ago, and we wanted to salute those who are serving overseas. I know many of you listen to this show as well, and we mourn the loss of Tristan Smith, and as well as a St. Louis Fire Department emergency medical technician was killed in Iraq this past Monday. Christopher Walsh, 30 years old, was killed operating overseas in protecting our freedom. So again, we see our own losing their lives here in our country, and we also see those who are giving overseas protecting us over in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places that we're operating. On a fairly positive note, as you know, in July, FDNY firefighter Johnny Walters III of FDNY Rescue 1 and a longtime friend of ours received life-altering injuries in a motor vehicle accident resulting in the amputation of his right leg. If you recall, he was getting back into Rescue 1's truck and a taxi cab slammed into the back of that vehicle. And even though John has endured numerous surgeries and painful rehab, he is on his way to rehab, and he's on his way to a recovery. Unfortunately, lost his leg. In addition to his duties as a career firefighter in New York City, John has been a member of the Port Washington Long Island Fire Department for 20 years, and he currently serves as their first assistant chief. While we normally don't solicit on this show, I am asking for your assistance. And if you enjoy this show, obviously you get this show for free. If you can help us with this and help me with this personally, we'd really appreciate it. John's brothers and sisters from both Port Washington and FDNY have joined forces, and they're currently refurbing John's house, so the transition from hospital to home is as comfortable as possible. The firefighters are providing all the labor. They just need some cash to help build the house and fix it up so John can function well in there. So we're hoping that those of you listening to Through the Smoke can send a donation, no matter how small it is, to help your brother and sister firefighters renovate John's house so he can live. So if your business or especially your firefighters association can send a donation of any amount, it will really matter. So check below. There's a link for you. Click it. There's information on where you can send some money in. Again, we don't solicit often, so if we're asking, it must be a big deal. Another quick salute, Gordon Graham. Many of you probably know Gordon Graham. If you don't, you sort of do anyway. Gordon funds FirefighterCloseCalls.com, and he is a dear friend of the fire service, and he is a 30-year cop, and he retired last month as a commander with the California Highway Patrol. So if you've never had a chance to see Gordon Graham speak, and he's coming to a fire department near you, you want to listen. He's great. But he's not a firefighter, but he's a major fan of us, and he is probably the nation's expert in police and fire risk management. And he ain't right, trust me. So if you have a chance, listen to Now, he's right in what he says, but I'm talking about as far as what's going on up between the ears. Might be some issues with Gordon. I don't know if you've ever seen him speak, you know just what I'm talking about. Obviously, we say that lovingly. He's a great guy and a big friend to the fire service. So if you have a chance to hear Gordon speak, do so. Again, congratulations to Gordon Graham retiring from the California Highway Patrol. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
You're listening to Through the Smoke on Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Where did the Fire Act grants go? Where are the Fire Act grants? You know, they were out much sooner in past years, weren't they? Did you notice that they're still not out? Did you ask anybody at the federal level about it? Don't expect a straight answer. Watch the fingers point. And then listen for how much they tell you how much they love firefighters. How about just shutting up, folks? We don't care how much you love us right now. We don't need love. Love doesn't buy equipment or improve our ability to serve and go home. Where are the Fire Act grants? I don't think it has anything to do with the United States Fire Administration and nothing to do with FEMA. It has everything to do with the DHS folks who just cannot seem to stand the fact that the nation's fire service gets, quote, this kind of funding. You know, with elections around the corner, politicians are probably all over you and your firehouses in the coming weeks. You need to ask them, what happened to the Fire Act grants? And now they are saying that they're going to be out soon, I guess after a number of folks started kicking and screaming last year, rather not last year, but last week over this issue, because we're talking months and months and months late. Where's the money? It's not like it's their money, you know? But when you talk to the politicians, ask them, where are the grants? What is the holdup? Who's responsible? Why did this happen? And now tell us that you love us. You know, we're not all that tough to please. And while we could write about that alone and talk about that alone, a couple of simple factual, no dancing around and no bullshit answers to the question, what happened to the Fire Act grants this year might be a good way to improve election results. So I guess they're claiming now that they are going to be out. The program has been published. The grants are on the way. Matter of fact, yesterday the reauthorization paperwork went through and it appeared in the Federal Register that it's going to happen. So we're looking at Fire Act grants now being out in about 4 weeks. I'm not sure you should let go of this issue. I think when the politicians come by, and some of them are great, great people who absolutely do support firefighters, but whoever comes by, talk to them about whatever issues you've got, whatever the important issues are, and then ask them, what happened to the Fire Act grants? And can you get back to us on that issue? We'd really like to know, where was the money this year? A couple of tragic events this year, rather this week, that went down I want to share with you. for Montana Volunteer Fire. And these are all vehicle-related, gang. So if you ride or drive fire apparatus or EMS equipment, which would be all of you, pay attention for just a few seconds. Four Montana volunteer firefighters who rolled with their apparatus into the Stillwater River last week walked away from the crash. They had heavy smoke from fire conditions and visibility was zero, and the firefighters were, or the driver was going by feeling from ditch by ditch as they were creeping along. They couldn't see 5 feet ahead of themselves, and they had to get out of the area. The fire apparatus rolled onto the driver's side and well into a river, landing on its wheels. The firefighters were able to crawl out of the cab, but otherwise were uninjured. So those Montana firefighters, we're glad you're okay, but please be careful. Now, also in another related type of an incident, in Virginia, a fire tanker going way too fast, according to the cops, responding to a structure fire in Abbs Valley, Virginia, slipped off the road, flipped on its side, and rolled from the highway into a 15-foot deep ravine, pinning the assistant chief in the wreckage for almost an hour. Steve Mitchell, 44 years old, of Bluefield, Virginia, assistant chief of the Abbs Valley Bossevane Volunteer Fire Department, was the lone occupant of the vehicle. Fire and rescue members had to use rams and saws to get the assistant chief out of the wreckage. He was responding to that fire last week when he lost the brakes on a 78 Chevy tanker truck that he was driving, according to the Virginia State Police. He had told the cops, I guess, he had said to the cops that he had just gotten the truck out of the shop, and he pushed down on the brake pedal and went all the way to the floor. The skid marks at the scene were yaw marks, which is consistent with what he reported. The truck was going way too fast, and he was trying to stop. But these, again, are comments according to the cops. You know, tankers carry all this water, have all this weight. We've got to slow down. We're talking with some folks the other day. Maybe the answer is no lights and no sirens on tankers, and you just go routine. Would it save that much? Would it matter that much, or would it get us there safer? I don't know. In some areas, tankers are first due. And if you got to get there quick, maybe you need that emergency equipment, but we've got to figure out a solution to the tanker problem. More and more tanker incidents here lately, don't you think? And also in Virginia, a Fredericksburg firefighter was injured last week when he was hit by a car while responding to a vehicle fire. Firefighters responded to this fire, and as they were getting off their engine company, a car that had been parked on the side of the road began to back up. We've got to watch out for these people. We've said it 100 times. When we're on the roadways, you got to act as if every civilian in a car is planning on hitting you. Their plan is to run you over. Now, operate knowing that. That firefighter was hit in the legs, and it pushed him against the engine and was transported and treated for a broken right fib and had stitches in his left leg. So we've got to pay attention. Watch out for these people on the roadways. And in South Carolina, the Highway Patrol says that Eugene Simmons struck a Sumter County fire apparatus last Sunday. Reports are that the apparatus had sirens and red lights on, attempting to turn left on a roadway. The driver of the, or that civilian driver, attempted to pass the apparatus in another car. The civilian struck the fire truck. He traveled off the left side of the road and overturned. Investigators say the civilian was not wearing a seatbelt and was ejected from the car and was pronounced dead at the scene. Civilians, don't pass our fire trucks and wear your seatbelts. And in Kentucky, a firefighter was accidentally struck by a state trooper last week at the scene of an interstate auto accident. So again, please pay attention. Please be careful. So much of this is avoidable, and you've got to be so aware of what's going on. And it's not easy. Between you trying to get your equipment on, you're trying to respond, you're trying to talk on a radio, it really is difficult. But we have no choice. We've got to do everything we can to avoid tragedies, and some tragedies are not avoidable. For example, last weekend, an FDNY engine company was responding to a fire call, and they struck and killed a 12-year-old boy. The boy was crossing a street in Queens when the apparatus hit him around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The engine with 6 firefighters on board was going to a fire. Turned out to be nothing serious. But this child who lived a few doors down from where he was hit was DOA upon arrival at the hospital. New York City roads were slick with rain due to the remnants of Tropical Storm Ernesto, and there's no criminal charges being applied to this. This is just a sad, sad situation of the kid slipping and falling into the street. The apparatus was attempting to avoid a double-parked car when the boy was crossing the street at the time, He stopped when he saw the truck, but he slipped and he fell on the rain-soaked ground. So our hearts go out to the family, but also to the firefighters who were involved in that. Obviously, from police reports, a completely unavoidable situation, but tragic nonetheless. And lastly, our hearts go out to the firefighters in Indiana, the Posey Township Fire Department, where last week a firefighter was killed. Eric Miller, the assistant chief, was driving a tanker, to assist another fire department with a structure fire. As he was responding and coming out of a curve, the tanker went off the road. The driver overcorrected, causing the vehicle to go off the other side of the road, and firefighter assistant chief Miller was ejected when the truck began to roll. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Listeners to Through the Smoke, please put your seatbelts on. And I know they're awkward. I know they're uncomfortable. In some cases, they barely fit. You know what? Don't wear your gear. Put your gear in a compartment. Get in the truck. Put your belt on. You can't get ejected when you've got your seatbelt on. And two final quick issues before we go speaking with Chief Freddie LaFamina from FDNY. Line of duty death accounting. The United States Fire Administration report for 2005 includes a total of 115 dead firefighters. This includes 99 deaths that would have qualified under the old criteria and 16 additional deaths that qualify under the Hometown Heroes criteria, which ties into the heart issue. The NFPA reports in 2005 that 87 of us died, and the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation is planning to honor 107 firefighters. Now, that includes the 100 who died in 2005 and 7 who died in previous years. The point of this discussion is, why can't we have one way of reporting? And the good news is that coming up at Fire Rescue International in Dallas, the IAFC's International Fire Conference coming up this week, that the USFA, the NFPA, the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, and the IAFC's Safety, Health, and Survival Section are all going to sit down at the table and discuss the fact that maybe there is one way we can come up with reporting firefighter deaths. After all, when the USFA is looking at 115, the NFPA is looking at 87, and the NFFF is looking at 107, we've got to have, at least in my opinion, one way of reporting firefighter deaths. So then once we have a number, we can continue to work on reducing those numbers. Somebody also called the other day, and they said, what's the deal? These deaths and injuries keep happening. And yeah, they do, but you know what? There is a change. You can't go in a firehouse in this country where there's not more of a focus on whether it be slowing down, wearing your seatbelts, wearing all your gear, making sure you have enough companies on the scene, staffing, training. It really is turning around. It's going to take a while. We can't impact the smallest number, and that's the 100 or so that we're losing each year, without impacting those who get injured or hurt. So we are starting to see the injuries drop. We are starting to see the more controllable situations get controlled. The training events, is it going to happen overnight? Absolutely not. But don't give up. We absolutely are starting to see a big change in what's happening to those in this business of ours. And lastly, I've got one more to share with you. This is about looking out behind your apparatus. In Waterbury, Connecticut, five firefighters and the driver of a car were sent to the hospital last week. They were going to a fire call, and the driver and an engine company was parking their apparatus, and a Honda slammed into the back of the apparatus. And certainly we saw something similar happen in FDNY. I just mentioned about firefighter Walters and how maybe you can help him by sending in that donation. But a very similar thing happened in Waterbury, Connecticut. These firefighters, lucky, they were not standing in the back of the rig when this happened. Pay attention to the back of your apparatus. Look behind you. Before you get out of the cab, take a look and see where the civilians are again. They're out to get us. We've got to be very, very careful. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Battalion Chief Freddie LaFamina from FDNY to talk about some recent events as well as USAR teams. We'll be right back. You're listening to Through the Smoke at RadioFirehouse.com.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke, only on Firehouse.com.
Hey, we're back. This is Through the Smoke on radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. You know, I just got back from the Freedom Center in downtown Cincinnati, not too far from my house. In 2001, a Cincinnati-based Delta Airlines flight attendant named Tanya Hoggard decided that following 9/11, she needed to go to New York City. She needed to do that. And while she met many of the firefighters who survived and many of the firefighters who worked at the site, she, for one reason or another, decided to do something. What Tanya did was to collect all the letters, cards, and posters that kids wrote to the FDNY firehouses, and she collected them for a future exhibit. She collected a lot of them. Now, I said she's a flight attendant. When I say collect, I mean tons of these letters, nearly 1 million, no kidding. And while I could tell you about the first years of her venture being very lonely and costing her loads of cash, the bottom line is that on Wednesday, September 6th, an exhibit opened in the beautiful National Freedom Center in downtown Cincinnati, right next to the stadiums. This is a first-class, proud-to-be-an-American exhibit that rivals any that I've seen related to 9/11. And you can check it out here on the website. There's a link there. Just click the link. Terry and I were so deeply moved by this exhibit. Absolutely unbelievable. And it's going to be open through the holidays. So if you're planning on going to Cincinnati for whatever reason, or even if you don't have a reason, this exhibit is a must-see for families. So what did I tell you about that for? Well, because something was done by someone that had nothing to do with 9/11. Nothing to do with being a firefighter, nothing to do with being a cop. But this is just a regular civilian who decided to do something. And also on September 6th, right next door to FDNY 10 House, Engine 10 and Truck 10, the Tribute Center opened up. That's a project of the September 11th Families Association. And this is an amazing, amazing exhibit. So if you have plans to go to New York City, click the link below as well and check out this exhibit. The Tribute is a place where visitors can learn about the events of February 26, 1993 and September 11th, both World Trade Center attacks. And you learn from the people who know, the friends and families of firefighters, police officers, and civilians who were murdered on 9/11. And you learn it through the voices of the individuals in these exhibits and the programs. The 9/11 Tribute will inform, educate, and provide a place for reflection all about 9/11 and what happened on that dreadful day when the World Trade Center and the rest of our country was attacked. So check it out. Learn from those who will know, not some street vendor hawking photos and tours of the World Trade Center site. Go talk to the folks who were there who know. So please spend some time and check out this link to the Tribute Center in New York City. Those are two very positive examples of helping us never forget. And with 9/11 just coming up next week, or perhaps it's right now or after if you're listening to the show late, there are many, many other examples as well. So many firehouses across the USA, Canada, and the world have established plans or have memorials so that people don't forget. On the other hand, I sometimes get very dismayed that so many folks have forgotten, absolutely forgotten. When I see what the New York City-based September 11th Families Association did, as well as what folks like Tanya did, it gives me hope. It gives you hope, I'm sure. Hope that civilians see their efforts and remember and actually give a damn. Now, before we go thinking it's a public problem, let's also look at ourselves and those who are involved with us. Never forget, civilians who never forget, I gave you some good examples of that. But what about fire departments and firefighters who have forgotten what 9/11 was and what it means? Forgotten what it means that we were attacked and thousands of Americans were murdered. And just when I thought it was safe to think that firefighters would not forget, I got an email this week from some firefighter friends asking for information about any 9/11 ceremony they could attend since no one in their area fire departments had anything planned. I don't understand that. How can any fire department not have anything planned? It costs nothing. So then what does it take? It takes a little effort and caring about being an American firefighter. Actually taking an hour or so to hold a community or regional service event or march or whatever, so we remember. How tough can that be? How can any fire department not have something planned? On the other hand, if your fire department has nothing planned, it certainly says a lot about your specific fire department. There is no other appropriate group in any community than the firefighters to take the lead and make sure that there is always a memorial service and remembrance on 9/11. Speaking of 9/11 and focusing on New York City, our guest today, as you know, is Battalion Commander Chief Freddie LaFamina from the Rescue Battalion Special Operations of FDNY. Welcome, Freddie.
How are you doing, Bill? How is everybody out there?
It's good, and it's a pleasure to have you, and I know your schedule is kind of nuts this time of year. I know you just came off a standby from the potential hurricanes down in Florida, and we appreciate your time. Freddie has been with FDNY for quite a while, and it's a tough time again for him and FDNY members and all our nation's firefighters, and there's not a single firefighter that shouldn't feel it. The recent line-of-duty deaths of firefighter Lieutenant Howie Karpluk and probationary firefighter Mike Riley numbed FDNY in an organization that's also preparing for the fifth anniversary of 9/11. Chief LaFamina has responded to numerous tragic events, including 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, as well as most recently the tragic fire in the Bronx. In addition, Freddie is the team leader of New York Task Force 1's USAR team and has decades of civilian and firefighter rescue experience, saving firefighters and saving civilians, both in New York City and across the USA. So, Freddie, before one of the conversations I want to have with you today is about rescue company operations at the most recent fire and other fires, but I also want to talk about the FEMA USAR team system. I remember last year when you were down in the Gulf Coast, and you and I were chatting on a regular basis. I remember one firefighter calling me all pissed off. He says, how come they get to go down there? Why does USAR get to go? So before we talk about why USAR gets to go and the history of USAR teams and why USAR teams are such a value to us, what can you share with us about the fire that tragically took the life of Lieutenant Karpluk and Firefighter Riley?
Well, that specific day, I was not the chief in the car that day. I was not working my tour. I did respond from home. I am a responder when there's a major incident, so I did respond. By the time I arrived, all firefighters had been removed. There was no talk of any deaths at that time. We had a couple of guys who they felt was a firefighter Riley was unconscious when they pulled him out, and the lieutenant was kind of not doing that well at that point. Preliminary, from what I've got from personnel at the scene from the rescue companies, we actually used almost every rescue company at the scene due to the fact we had five firefighters trapped. It seemed like the fire was knocked down. It almost seemed like it had small pockets of fire left. And again, this is what I'm getting from these guys, just speaking to them.
Sure, this is, yeah, this is, sure, just, absolutely.
Just kitchen talk. And it just went down. No warning, no sound. It seems to be there may be a construction defect in the building itself. It did have previous fires, was renovated, and just looking at it, it was one of those 99-cent stores, a lot of stock, a lot of heavy weight. Every time we talk about collapse, we talk about the weight of the stock, the weight of the firefighters, the weight of the floor. If the construction is shoddy or insufficient, these are the things that are going to happen. It's just tragic that these two brothers are going to lose their lives.
Right. Now, I understand that they actually activated Rescue Company 6, which was in service for a short period of time after 9/11 and is now basically a reserve rescue company staffed by off-duty members when needed. Is that right, Freddie?
Exactly. We have two of those. We have Rescue 6 and 7. The amount of area we cover, it's not so far-fetched. We'd have two or three major incidents going on simultaneously. So to provide service to the city of New York, we have these two fully equipped heavy rescue trucks, personnel on standby ready to man them, and within 45 minutes to an hour after activation, we could have them in service covering the city.
Outstanding. Well, that's great. Well, we certainly extend our condolences to all the members of the job, as well as the families of Howie Karpluk and Mike Riley. Just reading about, and I'm not sure if I'd ever met Howie, or not. I know talking to you and Mike Wilbur and some others, they say this was a real top-of-the-line guy and a real character, and I wish I had a chance to meet him. And if you just look at his history of the job and his history in the community where he lived out in Long Island, he immersed himself to do the right thing, and a real tragic loss, leaving behind his 11-year-old daughter and 13-year-old son. And Mike Riley, who had served a tour of duty in Iraq, was a Marine, and he had served as a volunteer in, it looks like, two or three different departments prior to getting on the job in New York City. Another example of a guy who probably took a major pay cut to get onto that job, and I wish some people would understand that sometimes.
Yeah, the guy who didn't pay us.
yeah, right. That's who I'm talking about. That's right. Well, let's talk about you, Sar, and that was my intent to talk to you, and we've been trying to schedule you on the show for a long time. I know you're very, very busy, and we appreciate the time that you've devoted. I guess the history of the USAR team started in the early 80s. Fairfax County, Virginia Fire and Rescue and Metro Dade Fire created these elite search and rescue teams. And I guess at that point, Ray Downey sort of got plugged in to sort of take the lead and get them organized and move them up toward more of a national a level and working with FEMA. It looks like here from what I'm looking at in 89, they established the structure, the national structure for the FEMA USAR teams, and there are still 25 teams. Is that right, Fred?
No, there's 28 at the present
28
time.
Teams, okay.
28 teams.
Okay, there's 28 teams, and then the teams responded to the 95 bombing in Oklahoma City. They've responded to incidents outside the United States, such as earthquakes in Turkey and Greece, and, of course, the 9/11 responses. So tell us about, let's start with New York Task Force 1. I understand that that's a team that's not just FDNY, but also consists of NYPD SU and others as well. Talk about your team, Freddie, because are you still the team leader?
Yes, I'm the task force leader, as well as I'm on the I'm an alternate on the incident support team. I'll usually respond to one of the three. I was usually a branch commander or something in the field. I'm more operational and at the command level.
Okay, and the structure of the New York team is unique, where the police are involved.
It is unique. Well, when Chief Downey wanted to get this team together, you know, there was some talk of incorporating the police department, and they do have, as everybody knows, emergency service units, and these members are trained to a certain level in rescue work. We also needed canines at the time, and they were able to provide that discipline to us. And as of now, we have equal parts between fire, including EMS, and the police department as it stands now. So when we deploy as a team. Nobody wears fire or police stuff. We respond as a team from New York. So nobody knows if you're a police officer or a firefighter when you are operating.
Oh, very good. How does... I guess let's revert to the question that started me wanting to have you on the show, and why does USAR get to go? How does somebody, first of all, the 28 teams that exist across the country, and for those of you listening to the show, I've got a link right on the website here where you'll be able to look at some information on USAR, see where the teams are, and things like that. But when people who don't understand a USAR team have no idea, this is much more than just a rescue truck.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a whole functioning department in its own. The New York Task Force, self-sufficient for 96 hours, food, water, facilities, rescue equipment, clothing, whatever it is we have for that area. And that's the reason they don't allow more federal teams. It's too tough to manage. We're fighting for funding every year. Our funding fluctuates. Some years it's good, other years it's better. It's been tremendously funded after 9/11. A lot of work was volunteer work, and through most of the teams are run by fire departments. They took that concept and they incorporated it into their departments. But what's happening now is we have 28 federal teams, but we have over 75 state teams. So people that can't get into USAR, they're not sitting down and saying, well, I can't be with them, I don't want to be in it. So they're starting these local teams, and a lot of them are very talented. They're state-funded, have a lot of equipment, and actually a lot of them worked with me personally in Katrina, and I have to say they did a tremendous job.
Should there not be, though, a hierarchy where the local teams are an integral part or smaller part of the bigger teams as opposed to teams just being formed and kind of doing our own thing, so to speak?
Well, what happens is there's so much personnel needed to support the team. You need 210 responders available, three in every position, and there's numerous positions. So it is hard to just staff them and then get them trained and then talk them into taking volunteer training and not getting paid. So it's very, very difficult to manage one of these teams.
Are there too many teams, Freddie?
No, there's not. There's probably not enough federal teams due to the other areas of rescues we're branching out into for response. But budget-wise, we have too many teams.
How, when you say you're expanding out into additional services, such as what?
Okay, we have what they call now a Type 3 hurricane response team, which we've done. We sent a 28-man team out, and that's a light task force doing light type of collapse-type work with light structures, wood frame structures. To support them, we will send out a Type 1 70-man team who has the heavy equipment to deal with Class 1 reinforced masonry structures. So we get into those areas. We do standbys at the Democratic National Convention and the Republican National Convention. We'll put teams on standby so that we're staged in the event of a crisis. We're available to go to work without having to travel halfway across the country.
So when you say that you're on standby, how many, for example, in Boston, how many were on standby over what period of time? How many people?
Okay, for 7 days prior to the event, leading up to the event, we had two task forces, Type 1 staged.
Which is how many people?
With an IST. So you're looking at about 230 personnel.
Incredible.
Staged event. Last week, there were four USAR teams.
This is last week for the storms.
Right. Okay. Blue IST and the support personnel. We had 368 personnel at the staging area.
Freddie, ballpark, what did that cost just to be on standby?
$29 million.
To be on standby for a hurricane.
$29 million, but they're doing the right thing by having the resources in place, not having to play catch up.
That's where I was going with this discussion. You know, on one hand, people are going to bitch about the cost. On the other hand, they're screaming, "What are you doing about following Katrina?" And I think that was one of the lessons learned is to mobilize a lot quicker, even if it doesn't look like it's going to be that bad. You're better off safe than sorry.
Exactly. And they have enough intelligence to determine if it has the potential for a crisis, and that's the times they put these packages together and put them in place. Unlike everybody else, they're proacting instead of having a knee-jerk reaction and just reacting to the event. They're proacting this time.
Well, and it's good, and quite frankly, my opinion, and it's been pretty vocal on this show and other venues, now that there's a fire chief in charge of FEMA, there's an understanding of what needs to be done. As opposed to a civilian or a horse attorney or whatever was in charge in the past. How does someone get involved? Let's say I've got someone listening on the show and they want to get involved in the USAR team. How do they do that?
Well, the USAR team that they would like to apply for has to be available in their region, first of all. If not, there's other areas that they can pursue, such as state teams, local teams. Most states, I would say every state in this country, has some sort of rescue capability available. And if not that, they have a DMAT team. If you have medical specialty, if you're a communications guy, they're always looking for that specialty. So
DMAT
there are a lot of avenues available.
DMAT is Disaster Medical Assistance Team?
Right.
They're basically the EMS folks that call.
Exactly, but they can. I'll give you an example. We went up to the Binghamton floods last month. I took two 14-man swift water teams. I've integrated them into medical guys now into my team. I took a couple extra medics because these Type 1, Type 2, and Type 3 swift teams don't come with medics. So we're venturing into other areas, you know. New York City's pretty unique. You have to work for one of the departments to be eligible to be on the team.
Now, the talk about the state teams and the local teams, my concern is, and I don't mean by radio, but I mean operationally, interoperability. If the state teams are being formed, is there a link between the state teams and the FEMA USAR teams?
Actually, we do. We have a great relationship with them. What was happening was a lot of untrained personnel was showing up, and you being an incident commander, myself as well, I don't really like people working for me if I don't know their capabilities. So the state team started following our doctrines. They used our training. They used our methods. They used our personnel picking. They adopted everything that USAR did. So there are teams that we interact with on a regular basis, and we actually have meetings together. State teams are welcome to come to the federal meetings. They do show up. I'll use New Jersey as an example. They're probably one of the premier teams in the country, and they're not part of the federal system.
New Jersey Task Force.
New Jersey Task Force 1.
They got some very good state funding, too, I saw recently. They got like a dozen trucks and stuff.
They get $11 million a year, while USAR pays, like our team, $1 million a year. That's the difference.
I see, okay. Now, how much, so someone gets on a team, how much training are you talking about? And not everybody does everything, right?
Everybody's
a specialist.
Right. We set position descriptions, but I'll tell you where it starts to interact with the other disciplines. I get a confined space, I have to put a medic in the space. The medic has to have confined space technician level training. So here's a guy who is a medical specialist, but now he has to go through 80 hours of confined space training. And every year get into a space, whether at a drill or at a job. So it does require a lot of training, a lot of dedication, and a lot of time as well.
How long have you been involved since the onset?
No, our team started small in 89. Chief Downey had started it. I did not respond to the Oklahoma City bombing. I was pulled out of one firehouse to cover for another captain in special ops.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as they came back, I was on the team. I just didn't respond at that time.
What were some of the details you have responded to? I know you went to Katrina, and I'd like to talk about that after. But what's some of the other ones you've been on, Fred?
Well, I've been to. We did some local jobs, like the hurricane in the Dominican Republic, Hurricane Georges. I mean, that was a major debacle. We sent the New York team over there, search and rescue. I've done standbys at the Atlanta Olympics in '96. I've done standbys at the DNC and the RNC. Last year alone, I responded to Katrina and Rita. I think I have about 11 deployments under my belt now.
Okay. Let's talk about Katrina. I know at one point you and I were on the phone, and we were able to pull a few strings to help you get some stuff done down there. What are your reflections if you were going to talk to your brother firefighters? What'd you see down there? What was good? What was bad? What needs to be done better?
Well, the commanders, I mean, you got to understand, you can prepare for an event as much as you want. You could have as many assets in place as you want. And something like Katrina is so overwhelming, you're going to run into problems. No matter what, you're going to have major problems. It's just the nature of the beast and the dynamics of the operation as it goes on. The biggest concern I had was, after 9/11, I'll never forget, there was concern about the firefighters, you know, that were trapped, and the civilians, and the mission of rescue, and there was no other thought in anybody else's mind. But after a while, I kept seeing the firefighters working were breaking down, and they were breaking down big time, and it really wasn't being addressed properly.
You're talking about mentally.
Right, they have the best system in the world, yes. Matter of fact, when I go to USAR, I have to be debriefed every time I come back. And Chief Downey instituted that. He didn't let you go back to work until you spoke to somebody about what you saw and what you did. So I'm telling you, I'm at a command meeting in Gulfport with the mayor, the chief of the fire department, and the brothers are there. The brothers in the firehouse. And I'm looking at them, and I'm saying the guys are going over command level. We're going to do this, this, and this. This is a priority area. This is what's going on. And I said, time out. I said, what about you? How do you guys feel? This is to the firefighters.
Right.
None of them had been home. This was 4 or 5 days into the incident. One brother had lost his child, didn't know the status of it. okay, this is what was going on, and I asked them, are you getting any help, guys, monetarily, housing, mental health?
The basic needs, sure.
Basic stuff. And they said, nope, we've asked the state, we've gotten nothing. I went to the state rep after my meeting. Of course, that mission was being carried out. I said, can you help these guys? He said, it's on the way, and that's when I called you. And like with everything else in government, you know, you call Paulson, he called me direct. I was right on the ground there in Mississippi, and he said, Fred, I'll have resources there tomorrow. And I was like, okay, and I know how busy that man is and how many things he had going on, but when those three representatives from his office walked up with housing arrangements, money, psychiatry help, I mean, you know, mental, whatever we needed, he had it, and that was most impressive.
Well, that's Dave Paulson. And,
yes,
And he, if he says he's going to do something, he will
right.
do it.
And you got to understand, so I'm way down the food chain, bro.
I'm
the last guy they got, you know. So, yeah. Very impressed.
Well, what Dave did for you down there is what he's now doing for the rest of us in this country as our
exactly.
our FEMA director.
You know,
talk about that the response from a mental and a mental health standpoint. We got DMAT teams, we've got communications teams, we got USAR teams. Is there a CISD team?
Yes.
And before I ask you about that, Freddie, I'm pro and con about that. I went to a recent line of duty death of a firefighter. Actually, the chief was a dear friend of mine, and I responded right out, and they lost a kid who was involved in saving a lady's life, and the floor broke through, and the kid was killed. And some probably well-meaning, quote-unquote, CISD folks showed up, and they could not have done more damage than they did to these firefighters because they weren't firefighters. And I know that they'll probably get the hair up on the back of some people in the audience, but I just don't know that if the initial debriefing of CISD should be done by people who don't understand what you've been through. And so my question is two-part. What are your experiences with that? And two, is there a national response system?
Well, the timing is most important. The timing has to be impeccable, and it never is. Really, at the beginning, is not a good time. I can't tell you a good time, but the timing is very important. When, you know what, I'm a firm believer in dealing with this now for a long time, is when that person is ready, that's when they'll be ready to talk to somebody. They need to open up. Other people need it quicker than the others in the fire service. I agree with you. We had no system really set up in New York City for that type of incident, and I got to tell you, there's a guy now that works in special operations. He works with us very closely, a civilian, and the guys love him. He walked very softly into the firehouse, and he spoke very softly, and when people didn't want to speak to him, he didn't push them, and he kind of knew his place, and he's now integrated himself into the whole system.
That's an example of, I guess, let me rephrase what I said. A civilian would be of value as long as they understand what we do and they
right.
study what we do, not just show
right.
up out of nowhere and start counseling
right.
firefighters after a tragic event. So what about the national system, Fred?
Well, the national system, they require you to have it built into your team. Now, I don't know if that's a requirement for state and local teams, but at the national level, you have to have personnel on your team assigned that handle that for you.
So when your team is deployed to a high-level response, you're getting the counseling folks along with you?
No, not on the deployment. We see them before we go and when we get back.
Okay, so they're back at home.
Right.
And what about doing?
As an incident commander, you're taking care of your men. You have to recognize when they need it. You know, it's up to us.
So you can call for them, too.
Exactly. So somebody gets so emotionally involved in an event, you got to pull them back for their own safety, you know.
Right.
So, it's all that whole SIDS thing. Yeah, it's great, but we have to make the initiative and recognize it and try to. And a guy needs help, you got to give it to him. This is in the old kitchen days. You go back to the kitchen, you know,
right.
have a cup of coffee and talk it over. You know?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head too. Timing is important, but there's no answer to the timing.
No, there isn't.
The bosses have to be aware enough of their folks to know that's normal behavior, that's not normal behavior, whatever the case may be, and have that resource available at pretty much any time.
Right.
Let me ask. I know you're tight on time today. I do have one more question for you, because I know the listening audience. And by the way, to the audience, thank you. You're approaching 150,000 downloads to these shows, and we sure do appreciate that kind of listenership. Freddie, where were you prior and on 9/11, prior to the event, and what was your role in 9/11?
Well, I was the captain of Squad 270 at the time in Jamaica, Queens. I was one of captain one of the seven squads. Due to geographics, I was not assigned to the fire, which is normal. I'm the furthest from the fire. Even on the 2/5 alarms, I'm still not assigned at that point. Of course, like every other guy, I wanted to go to the fire, but I stayed and spoke to the dispatcher, and he informed me for three of the boroughs, I was the only special unit available, so I had to stay in service. How I got to the fire eventually is one of the staff chiefs called for the USAR cache. That's the one thing. The USAR tools are available locally before anything else. If you need them locally, you're allowed to have them. So he wanted the USAR cache, and that kind of was my excuse to get to the fire. I'm not going to say excuse.
You had a need
right,
to be
so
there.
Right,
sure.
Don't forget, we had a total recall, so I had two sets of units. I had two apparatus. I sent one set of brothers with a lieutenant to get the cache. They tracked the trail, it over, and I went right to the site and went to work. I remember it vividly. Chief Carruthers was there. He said to me, get into there and see what you can do. And Pat McNally, who's now the chief of operations, said to me, the captain of Rescue 3 is trapped, find him. And then it just snowballed from there. But that was my initial operational objective.
And you then pretty much assumed the USAR role for the months to come, I assume.
Well, what I did, Billy, it wasn't so much a USAR role. We had lost all our command level structure in SOC.
Okay.
We were chaotic. There was no leader with a background. So I had to step up and say, okay, I need some structure. And I knew the USAR structure worked, because it gave me communications, it gave me accountability. You know, I knew where everybody was, I knew where they were working. You're talking, 300-400 guys, just in special ops alone, plus the retired guys, all these other guys that wanted to help. So that system allowed me, really the incident command system. Don't forget, we weren't big on incident command in those days. So mostly I used my incident command instincts, but just doing my job, that's all it was.
You know, we talk about responding, and just now you keyed in on it, and I want to make that an issue for our final discussion this morning. You wanted to go, but you didn't go. You did what the dispatcher told you. You stayed where you're supposed to. Self-deployment, a big problem on 9/11, appears to have been a problem for Katrina as well. And honestly, I don't know if it's going to be any better for the next event, because there will be a next event. We know that. And I remember years and years ago in the late 70s, I was at the firehouse. I was a lieutenant, and there was a big fire somewhere, and the crew came up and said, we need to go. Let's head that way. And I was dying to go, but I said, no, they didn't call us. We ended up getting in trouble. And, as much as I want to go anywhere, shit, I'll go 15 miles to see a dumpster fire. We need to stay put, and I guess that's the other thing is, as a generic firefighter, you're a general practitioner. As a USAR member, you're a specialist, and general practitioners may not be needed at the scene of many of these disasters. On the other hand, firefighters get frustrated when they see what happened down at Katrina and think, well, I can help, and they self-deploy. What are your thoughts on self-deployment?
I'm totally against it. I don't agree with it, but it's not going to stop. It's going to continue to happen. And I use the old adage, good intentions, undisciplined. Okay? And that starts from the firefighter to the company officer to the chief officer to the staff level. They have to somehow get control of that. And if they can, you'll have some sort of accountability. But if we just have rampant personnel running around with no accountability, we're going to lose somebody, somebody's going to get killed, and it's going to be our own fault. The one good thing that happened in Katrina is I didn't run into a Swedish rescue team who had not reported into the EOC.
You did?
And They didn't, and I ran into them, and they were locked up immediately.
Sweden.
They locked them right up. The marshals came in and locked these guys up. They had pink and black outfits on.
I had not heard that story. Yeah. I had heard stories from other states, but I didn't know they came from Sweden.
No, from Sweden. And I'll tell you what, until that starts, where there's, you know, discipline instituted, you know, for being undisciplined, it's always going to continue. It's just a mentality of the firefighter. They have to help. You know?
Well, it starts at the top. If the boss says you're not going, you don't go.
You're in trouble, you know.
Yeah.
And once you send that message, it's a good thing because in the long run, we'll save many others. You know?
Sure. Well, we've been talking with Chief Fred LaFamina, who is the battalion commander of the Rescue Battalion, New York City Fire Department Special Operations, and the task force leader of New York Task Force 1, which is a FEMA USAR team. Freddie's got 20 years. How many years? 23?
22
years on the job. Has been recognized on numerous occasions for rescues and related good stuff that he's done. And adding to his list of good stuff is spending times with us this morning on the USAR team system and sharing with us a little bit about the fire that they tragically lost two members at a couple weeks ago in the Bronx. And his insight on the whole USAR response. Freddie, I'd like to have you back on another time to carry
sure.
this to the next level and talk a little bit about more about the training and exactly what these specialists do. We want to recognize and thank all the USAR team members as well as the state and local team members for the work they do, sort of the rescue companies that back us up and help us out when we get in trouble. So, Freddie, I know you got some activities coming up. And with 9/11 upon us, the fifth anniversary, I know that's heavy in your heart. So we wish everybody in New York the best, and I look forward to seeing you soon, brother.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
Okay. You've been listening to Through the Smoke at radio@firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.